KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. We all probably know the lyrics by heart. This land is your land. This land is my land. From
California
to the New York Islands. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. But what do we really know about the song itself? This Land Is Your Land was written by Woody Guthrie in 1940, and it's become the iconic American folk song. Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday would have been last year. Robert Santelli is the executive director of the Grammy Museum. He's the author of the book, This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song. Santelli spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on May 23, 2012.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for coming tonight. It's really nice to be back home. I say back home because I split my residence these days between Bainbridge Island and Los Angeles, where, as you know now, I run the Grammy Museum. But my first love is American music, and American music with a twist. American music that has, if you will, allowed itself to be part of American history and allowed itself to be part of the American experience and allowed itself, in particular with Woody Guthrie, to be an agent for social and political cultural change in this country. And when I think about that, there's only one artist, one musician, one songwriter that fits the bill so perfectly as if he were made to be the poster child for music with cultural and political ramifications, and that's Woodrow Wilson Guthrie. This is the centennial of his birth. On July 14th, Woody Guthrie was born back in 1912 in Okemah, Oklahoma. So how appropriate, I think, that I write a book about Woody Guthrie, second book, actually, on Woody Guthrie, that does something for me personally and that hopefully does something for you as well. I can't remember where I heard this, but I remember a writer saying, good writers write for themselves, meaning they want to know more about their topic. They want to know more about the story that they're telling, because you become not just emotionally invested in the topic at hand or the person, in this case, Woody Guthrie, but also it's almost like getting married to these people. When you write a biography, you know, you go to bed with this person, you wake up with this person, you argue with this person, you love this person, you don't like them so much today, maybe more tomorrow. It really is that way. And for me, for Woody Guthrie, it's been mostly a love affair. And so when I realized that the centennial was coming a number of years ago, and I'm good friends with Nora Guthrie, Woody Guthrie's daughter, and Arlo Guthrie, his son, I mentioned the possibility. I said that as a baby boomer, and some of you who are baby boomers might have had this same experience, but certainly back east this was a common occurrence, especially in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. I'm from New Jersey. In the 1950s and early 1960s, when we were mere tots, there was a pretty good chance that we would have heard This Land Is Your Land in our music class. You wouldn't have heard all the lyrics. They probably wouldn't have told you it was written by Woody Guthrie, because no one really knew or cared about Woody Guthrie in the 50s or 60s. He had already been sick with Huntington's disease. It was pretty much out of the picture. But thanks to Pete Seeger was the one who kept that song alive for us. And so in my elementary school class, we called it grammar school back in New Jersey at PS number one, I learned to sing by listening and to This Land Is Your Land, sung by some choir, if I can recall correctly, because many of them back then began to interpret this song. And it was a great sing-along song. So this is a song that countless music teachers in America in the late 1950s and early 1960s used in their classes to teach kids how to sing. Who knew that Woody Guthrie, with his song, one of his songs, would have had such a high honor, high pedigree in the American school systems, considering the history of the song? Pete Seeger kept it alive when Woody couldn't, and by the late 1960s, Pete Seeger had taught it to so many people, and so many people had heard it at summer camps, at progressive churches and socials and wherever Pete literally could sing the song, that it became, in essence, the alternative national anthem for progressive baby boomers. And there was actually a movement, very short time, but a movement of trying to make This Land Is Your Land the alternative American anthem. And when they dug down deep enough, and didn't have to go too far, but when they dug down deep enough and they realized that most of us were singing only part of the lyrics, and when they found out what the other sets of lyrics were, they kind of pulled back, and then they realized Woody Guthrie probably was a communist, and then that was the end of that. So there was no more attempt at making This Land Is Your Land anything more than what it was, a song by Woody Guthrie that was a great American folk song, but not that much in terms of matching it with the Star Spangled Banner or God Bless America. Now, I bring up God Bless America because we all know that song, much like we know This Land Is Your Land, and there's a great connection there. In February 1940, when Woody Guthrie wrote the song This Land Is Your Land, God Bless America was being sung on the radio, particularly by Kate Smith, the most popular radio personality of the 1930s, again and again and again. Actually, she sang it for the first time in 1938, which at that time was called Armistice Day, and then it was later called Veterans Day. And that song, God Bless America, you probably know something about. It's one of the most famous American songs written by Irving Berlin back during World War I. And Berlin had put that song away. He had written it for a particular musical that he had composed while he was actually in the U.S. Armed Forces. Never served abroad, but he had it and didn't use it in this musical. And so what he did was he put it in the trunk. Long story short, 20 or so odd years later, it gets resuscitated when Kate Smith's manager calls Berlin and asks Irving Berlin, do you have a patriotic song that Kate could sing on the air for this new Veterans Day, Armistice Day celebration? And Irving Berlin says, I did have something. And he goes back into his files. Actually, his secretary goes back into his files, finds God Bless America. She sings it on the air and makes radio history. America overnight goes crazy for the song. In short order, in a matter of months, Congress is debating whether that should be the new national anthem. So it was all over the place. It was on jukeboxes because many artists had recorded it. It was sung by Kate Smith virtually everywhere she performed and always on the radio. Guthrie heard this and heard it again and heard it again and heard it again. And basically, we don't know this for sure, even though I've gone through the Woody Guthrie archives pretty closely. There's no indication, as many people say, it was Guthrie saying, that's enough. I can't stand this song anymore. I'm going to write my own song. He did. He called it God Blessed America, which would eventually become known as This Land Is Your Land. So the origins of This Land Is Your Land is very much connected to God Bless America. My sense is, talking to Pete Seeger and then Arlo, who had spoken to his dad about the song, is that, A, Woody Guthrie thought the world of Irving Berlin. I mean, how could you not? He was a brilliant, brilliant songwriter, and Woody Guthrie recognized the genius there. Second, Woody Guthrie heard that song as a hit song that it was, and wished that he too had a hit song, even though his music was hardly ever played on the radio, except on progressive left-wing stations in the late 30s and then into the 1940s. And C, he probably felt like he did all the time that he needed to respond to it. And that's probably the most important thing about the origins of this song, This Land Is Your Land, formerly known as God Blessed America. Guthrie was the kind of artist, kind of songwriter, who would read a newspaper in the morning, cut out three or four articles that he found particularly insightful or interesting or that he agreed or disagreed with, and in the afternoon, he wrote songs about them. Thousands of these. We know at least 3,000 songs that he has written. Now, when I say songs, many of them are just lyrics. He wasn't a great melody writer. He did write some, but oftentimes he would borrow just like you borrow "This Land Is Your Land" from an old Carter song, and then the Carter family borrowed it from an old gospel hymn. I mean, this was common back in the pre-war years to liberally take the essence of melodies and then redo them so that they fit your need for your particular song. But Guthrie did this with many, many, many songs. Some of his best songs that he ever wrote were responses to things that he had heard or that he had written, he had read, I should say. When it came to Irving Berlin, you could not escape the presence of that song. Literally, it was all over. I don't know whether Guthrie had in mind to write this song. I was thinking about it. Some people feel that maybe that was the case. I don't. Guthrie was a very impulsive kind of guy. He probably heard it that morning and said, "That's it, I'm writing the song." Interesting, like Irving Berlin, he wrote the song in February 23rd, 1940, in Hanover House, a Fleabag hotel that no longer exists in Midtown Manhattan. And he put it away. He didn't think much of it, number one, or he didn't think it was complete, that he didn't feel it was finished, because there are a number of very, very important benefits and rallies that Woody Guthrie would sing at in the immediate months with Alan Lomax and Leadbelly and Pete Seeger and so many others of the cream of New York's intellectual leftist elite, that you would have thought that he would have played this song if he thought, A, it was done, or B, it was great. He had written songs about the subway, the Bowery, Midtown Manhattan. He wrote all kinds of songs about New York, and he would play them the next day or two or three days later, tried them out on people. There's no indication that Woody Guthrie did that with "This Land Is Your Land." He put it away. He thought enough of it, however. He wrote it on loose leaf paper, binded three-ring paper, and I think he thought enough of it because he put those little, you know, those little preservers, those holder preservers, you know, you lick them and you put them on there, and he did that. And he wrote it with his best penmanship, as if it were going to be preserved. So there's a lot of things about this song. He didn't play it live, yet he certainly was someone who thought that this ought to be preserved. He didn't want to lose it. It takes a number of years, about 5 years or so, before he actually records it. And when he does, he records it for MOASH, Folkways Records, which eventually would become known as Smithsonian Folkways Records. And when he ultimately recorded it and he sat down, he recorded it with dozens, literally dozens of other songs, old standards, folk music standards, songs that he had learned from his mother that certainly were from the Anglo-Irish balladry of the old world, if you will. Songs that he had written that were very topical about New York, about Hitler, about whatever it was on his mind. And then somewhere in the second or third session, maybe after 100 or so songs had been written, had been recorded, he records "This Land Is Your Land." Mo Ash later on would say, "I knew it was a great song. I knew it was a great song." But he didn't release it until some years later in the early 1950s. The only one who was truthful about the song, in my view, was Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger honestly said, "When I heard the song for the first time, I didn't think it was a good song. It didn't move me. It had too much of a sing-songy kind of quality to it." And as a result, Pete Seeger kind of pushed it aside too. Eventually, however, he realizes the genius behind the song. And if you know the song, you think about what is stated in that song. It's one of Guthrie's most poetic songs. If you hear the beautiful poetic descriptions of America, which is why in the 1950s we learned how to sing it during the Cold War, it was considered to be a patriotic song. The story of how that happens, I said, was part Pete Seeger. The other part was Guthrie's publishing company. Larry and Howie Richman, actually Howie Richman, the father, was Woody Guthrie's publisher. He had given Woody Guthrie in the late 1940s a tape recorder. And he says, "Anything that you do, just put it down on tape so we can get it and we can get it published." He thought the man was brilliant. The problem, though, was this was the late 1940s. By this time, Woody Guthrie's Huntington's disease was setting in. And his mind wasn't as clear or as sharp. His vision wasn't acute or focused. And his sense of writing genius had been dulled. People thought he was drinking too much because he often staggered Huntington's will rob you of your balance. He was slurring his words. We didn't know about Huntington's, that it would ultimately kill you. It was incurable. Most people didn't. Doctors knew, but it was hard even at that point to diagnose. So Guthrie was deemed a drunk. And Richmond, nonetheless, felt his work was still important and it ought to be preserved. By 1954 or so, Woody Guthrie is done. I mean, he is now... we know he knows he has Huntington's. There's nothing he can do about it. He probably knew a lot earlier because his mother died of Huntington's, and he knew the ravages of this disease that literally destroyed their family. And so Richmond finds out about it, Howie Richmond finds out about it, and feels that his songs, especially this one song, This Land Is Your Land, the song that Pete Seeger had been singing, begun to be singing at these churches and at these summer camps, etc., in these schools, and makes pretty much a landmark decision that he tells school book publishers that if they would buy some of Woody Guthrie's songs or some of the other songs that they were carrying, like Alan Lomax's songs, etc., Lead Belly songs, that they would throw in this really great patriotic song called This Land Is Your Land for free. So the reason why This Land Is Your Land is known by so many music teachers, some of them may have known Pete Seeger, but probably many didn't in Iowa or Idaho or Maine, but they got the textbooks. And in the music textbooks was this song, This Land Is Your Land. And if you could play it and you can hum it, you realize what a great sing-along song it is. And look at those lyrics, how beautiful they describe America. What was missing were the pair of verses that criticized America. Because as much as this song was about the glories of America, its natural beauty and the promise of the American dream, the last two verses questions, was this land made for you and me? He doesn't take the Irving Berlin point, like this land is great, it was blessed by God, and everything is wonderful about it. Guthrie had seen too much in his days. Out in California, Central California, Southern California, where he was in the early 1930s, and saw many of his Okies and Arkies and Texies, people who had come from the Southwest and Midwest out of the Dust Bowl looking for promise and work and a new life, a new start in California, only to be not only denied the job, but now no place to go and being beaten by cops and beaten by thugs who were hired by the big ranchers and the big fruit growers who were trying to make these men and women work for as little as possible. Guthrie was right there writing about it, documenting it in song. So when Guthrie hears God Bless America, Irving Berlin's, he's saying, you only got it part right. I'm going to write the song that tells the full story. And he does. And so when you hear those songs about my people standing online at the relief office, okay, or you hear him talk about he'd been through this country so much, and he was very upset about how more and more land had been just taken up, gobbled up by banks and by rich Americans, and in its place was a fence and a no trespassing sign. There's a great lyric in one of the unused verses that basically said, comes across a sign, it says, no trespassing. On the other side, it didn't say anything, and that side was made for you and me. So you get the point that Guthrie knew the full story because he experienced it. Berlin didn't. Even though Berlin was an immigrant and a very poor immigrant at that, Russian immigrant, by the time Irving Berlin writes God Bless America in 1918, he is someone who is very well off. He has a chauffeur, he has a cook, etc. Guthrie, he was the kind of guy where you would offer him a bed to sleep in, and he'd say, nah, I'd rather sleep under the table. And the person offering the bed would say, well, why would you want to do that? He would say, well, I don't want to get too comfortable. I don't want to get used to the comfort. I'll just stay here. So he was a person who, yes, he did hop freights. There's a lot of mythology about Woody Guthrie for sure, but a lot of it is pretty close to the truth. He was the kind of man that felt deeply connected to America's underbelly. He felt deeply connected to the disenfranchised, to people who did not get their fair share. He wrote a great, great song about Pretty Boy Floyd, the outlaw, and makes him into, you know, Robin Hood, and makes him into, you know, a folk hero. And in quite honestly, in many parts of Oklahoma, he was just that. But Guthrie was one of those kind of people.
Robert Santelli, executive director of the Grammy Museum and the author of This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song. Santelli spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on May 23, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. The sign was painted, said private property. But on the back side, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling. And the wheat fields waving, and the dust cloud rolling. A voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
More from Robert Santelli in a moment, 827 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow evening, stories of unintended consequences from Radiolab. They call it their Oops Show. Think about it. You come up with a great idea. You devise a plan. You control for every variable, or at least everyone you can think of. Once everything's in place, the train hops your carefully laid tracks. We're going to get a look at how one psychologist's zeal to safeguard national security may have created a terrorist. Also, one community's efforts to protect an endangered bird have deadly consequences. And against all odds, a toxic lake spawns new life. It's all tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow morning, we're going to visit a tiny town in the Appalachian foothills in Pike County, Ohio, where, for a century, residents have shared the common bond of identifying as African American despite their white appearance. Racial lines have been blurred to invisibility, and people inside the same family can vehemently disagree about whether they're black or white. It can be tense and confusing. As a result, everyone's choosing, am I black, am I mixed race, or am I white? Adding to the confusion, there's also an effort to recognize their Native American heritage. It's all tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 50s, partly cloudy this evening, then becoming cloudy. Friday highs lower to mid-70s, cloudy in the morning, then becoming partly sunny.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. You sang it in elementary school, summer camp, or church, and you probably still remember the lyrics. Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land is arguably the most iconic American folk song, and at one point, there was even a movement to make it the alternative national anthem, before people started realizing the political messages hidden in some of the seldom-sung verses. Robert Santelli unravels the song and the life of Woody Guthrie in this talk, recorded at the Elliott Bay Book Company on May 23, 2012.
Now, Guthrie's persona and Guthrie's music appeals to a certain young Jewish boy in Minnesota, of all places, a young Bob Zimmerman, who would later be known as Bob Dylan. A lot of people think it was Woody Guthrie's music that really turned Bob Dylan onto Woody Guthrie. Well, certainly that was at least partially the case. The other part was a book that Woody Guthrie had written. If you are a Guthrie fan, you need to read, especially this year in his centennial, Bound for Glory. One of the great, I can't call it a novel, I can't call it an autobiography, you really got to call it a fictionalized autobiography, because he didn't recognize the difference in boundaries between the truth and the non-truths. And so Guthrie just happened to tell a great story, and much of it was true, some of it wasn't. But but Bob Dylan read that and drops out of the University of Minnesota and becomes essentially a Woody Guthrie wannabe. So much so that he comes east. He knows Woody Guthrie is dying in a New Jersey hospital. He wants to meet Woody Guthrie before Woody Guthrie dies. Bob Dylan shows up in the early 1960s looking like Woody Guthrie, talking like Woody Guthrie, singing like Woody Guthrie, dressing like Woody Guthrie. People are astounded when they actually see him. There's a great story in a book that Nora Guthrie and Arlo told me about Bob Dylan showing up at their house wanting to meet Woody Guthrie. And the babysitter didn't have a clue who this person who didn't smell so great, just come off the road, and looked just like their dad. And didn't want to let him in the house, but Arlo saw that he had a harmonica and says, "Oh, you play music? Come on in. Let's sit down and play." So the two of them played Bob Dylan, then got invited to go to the hospital to meet Woody Guthrie. That was his dream. And, of course, he becomes, in essence, the new Woody Guthrie. He becomes what Guthrie couldn't be in the 60s because of the disease. Dylan carries it on, at least for a few years. By 1965, of course, Bob Dylan isn't Bob Dylan anymore. He's simply Dylan, and he has completely changed. He's moved on from the Woody Guthrie aspect, and now he's this urban hipster writing songs like a Rolling Stone and albums like Bringing It All Back Home and Highway 61 Revisited, just great American classics. But for that early 60 period, it's Bob Dylan. And in Bob Dylan's repertoire, This Land Is Your Land, of course. So you have Bob Dylan, you have Pete Seeger still singing along, and you have a number of other artists, Phil Oakes, Tom Paxton, Peter, Paul, and Mary, the Limelighters, the Kingston Trio, and others, all singing now Woody Guthrie songs in the early 1960s. And presenting his music to a certain element, those who are willing to listen and understand. Because you got to remember, in the early 1960s, this is a time when the Beatles are just ready to hit in 1964. But prior to that, you know, there was a folk revival movement of serious consequence in urban areas and on college campuses. And those people knew about Woody Guthrie. Well, they could only know about him because there was nothing about him that was being written. He would die in 1967, and by 1968, a memorial concert had occurred, and basically, Woody was put to rest, but his songs lived on, particularly This Land Is Your Land. We can go on through the rest of the 20th century, but let me bring it up a little bit closer to today, because as Pete Seeger and Arlo Guthrie and others carried on Woody Guthrie's legacy, by 1980, there's a new person involved in this, and that's Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen hadn't known about Woody Guthrie. He'd sang, just like I did. We grew up on the Jersey Shore together, and he had sung This Land Is Your Land in school, just like all of us did, but didn't know the story, didn't understand the consequence, the cultural and political consequences of Woody Guthrie's music. But 1980, a biography, the first major biography of Woody Guthrie occurs. It's called Woody Guthrie, A Life by Joe Klein. You might know Joe Klein if you read Time Magazine, I think it is. Time Magazine. He's a columnist in Time Magazine. And he's written Primary Colors and others. Great, great writer. And Springsteen got a hold of that and read it and was blown away by the story of Woody Guthrie. Almost instantly starts to put This Land Is Your Land into his repertoire. If you're a Springsteen fan, you'll also know at the time he puts out one of his best albums, I think, Nebraska, which is all about the dark side of America, much like Guthrie's songs were, but with a sense of optimism, much like Guthrie had in his songs. So Springsteen becomes the latest carrier of the Woody Guthrie legacy, particularly to rock audiences, who many of them now were not baby boomers anymore. They were Gen X or Gen Y and didn't grow up with This Land Is Your Land. May have heard it once or twice, but didn't understand the deep implications of it in terms of America and politics. And Springsteen pretty much takes it upon himself to teach everyone. The culmination of this story really is in 2009, a few days before Barack Obama's historic inauguration. And this is where the book ends, my book ends, because it really brings it full circle. Bruce Springsteen gets a call from the Obama camp asking if he would perform at the inauguration. Springsteen, being an Obama backer, says yes, but he would like to bring Pete Seeger. They'd like to do This Land Is Your Land. Obama people said fine. Bruce calls Pete Seeger up, and Pete Seeger says, I'd be happy to do it with you, providing we sing all the verses. And Bruce Springsteen said, I'd have it no other way. So if you could recall that historic time, and when millions upon millions of Americans, as well as people from all over the world, they tuned in their radios or their TVs, and they heard Bruce Springsteen and Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger, over 90 years old now, out there in that bitter January cold in Washington, D.C., with just a flannel shirt on and his hat. Bruce Springsteen had 14 scarves on and leather jackets. Pete said he sung better when he was cold. And they sing, of course, This Land Is Your Land. And I don't know where Woody Guthrie was. I know he was cremated. And when they threw his ashes off Coney Island, they blew back in everyone's face. He didn't want to leave. But wherever he was, I am certain that he felt very satisfied that the song that ultimately bore his legacy was sung at one of the most historic, maybe the most historic presidential election of all time. And how nice for, and how happy an ending for this song, which of course continues today, but clearly a chapter, a great part of that song's story had ended there. It picks up again. It's been reborn with Occupy. Occupy Wall Street and other Occupy movements, basically thanks to the latest Guthrie legacy carrier on, and that's Tom Morello. You may know him from Rage Against the Machine. Tom Morello now is the one. He's the one introducing Woody Guthrie, and particularly This Land Is Your Land, to the Occupy movement. And if there were a soundtrack for Occupy Wall Street or Occupy LA, or if there was one, I presume there was an Occupy movement here in Seattle, This Land Is Your Land and the Woody Guthrie songbook was really, became the musical, if you will, nourishment of the movement. And it's interesting, I watch very closely to see what role Guthrie's music will play and what role This Land Is Your Land in particular will play in this year's election. I hope a large one. It has that incredible power to galvanize. It has that power to inspire. Woody Guthrie, in my view, was a great American patriot, and this song is a great American patriotic tune. And it's most patriotic because it tells the truth. It tells both sides. America isn't a perfect country. Guthrie recognized that. Guthrie wanted it to be a perfect country. Guthrie strove for it to be a perfect country. And Guthrie used his music to have that come to an end. And even though the fight continues, and all you have to do is go back to the Woody Guthrie catalog and find out all the songs he wrote about immigration, about poverty, about banks, about people losing their homes because they couldn't pay mortgages, about hungry, about destitute, same problems that we face today. Maybe not with as deep and as dense as it were back in the Great Depression, but they're still here, which is all the more reason why Guthrie's music is relevant today, Guthrie's presence and inspiration is relevant today, and ultimately Guthrie's most famous song, This Land Is Your Land, is not only relevant, it's useful, and it is, in my view, necessary. So I hope to hear it more and more this year. I hope you do as well. And I hope it continues to be a song that acts as an agent for political and cultural and economic and racial and sexual change in this country. It all boils down to a song that can carry the common good and can carry the way America needs to go. And we'll see if that happens, but certainly This Land Is Your Land and Woody Guthrie, I think, are standing on the sidelines ready to pitch in one more time. Thanks very much.
Robert Santelli, Executive Director of the Grammy Museum and the author of This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island.
Santelli spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on May 23rd, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Robert Santelli in a moment. 841 94.9 KUOW. Gasoline has been the fuel of choice for Americans for some time, maybe always. People tend to think of diesel as a fuel for large trucks and Europeans, but popular car makers like Audi, Chevrolet, and Mazda are offering more diesel options on the U.S. car market this year. At the moment, only 3% of American drivers are choosing diesel, whereas 50% of European drivers are driving diesel cars. Mark Rechten, West Coast editor for Automotive News, talks about why more Americans aren't driving diesel. That's tomorrow during the noon hour. Grammy-winning violinist Mark O'Connor is one of the most multifaceted fiddlers on the scene today, equally at home playing bluegrass, country, jazz, and classical. He's a serious educator as well. His approach to teaching strings is considered a rival to the Suzuki method. Michael Feinstein and Mark O'Connor get together to explore American music, including a performance of Fats Waller's Ain't Misbehavin' on this week's Song Travels tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. There are political messages in the folk song, This Land Is Your Land. Don't remember them? Well, it's probably because they're rarely sung or taught to kids. Robert Santelli is the executive director of the Grammy Museum. He explores the roots and meanings of the song in the book, This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song. Santelli spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on May 23, 2012. Next, he takes questions from the audience. The first question is, did you know the song is being used for the Occupy Wall Street movement, notably by a group called Occupella in the Bay Area?
I don't, but I'm not surprised. I can tell you that during this centennial, there are Woody Guthrie celebrations and This Land celebrations literally around the world. As we speak, I think Nora Guthrie is in Germany, maybe Belgium, doing some of the centennial celebrations over in Europe. There have been a number here that we have done thus far and more coming. As a matter of fact, mark your calendar, October 14th, the Woody Guthrie centennial will be at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. It'll be a PBS special, which will be very exciting. So you might want to look for that. But that song has been recorded hundreds of times. When Arlo, this is the early 60s now, Arlo was about early teen, he told me that basically records would come in during the course of the week when his father was at the hospital. And during the weekends, they'd bring him home. And when they brought him home, one of Arlo's jobs was to take the records that were coming, languages, French, Italian, Spanish, whatever, and he would play these for his father. His father, it was hard for him to talk at that point, so it was a lot of gesturing. But Arlo said he was astounded. Week after week, new Woody Guthrie songs in Israel, whatever it might have been. It comes from all cultures, all languages. And, of course, the one that carried the most clout across the board was This Land Is Your Land. So the fact that others are doing things with it today, I'm not surprised at all. I'm happy. I'd like to hear a whole lot more of them. But they are continuing, and that's a good thing. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I had two, but one okay. Of them was kind of been chopped up, which is great, because I was going to kind of talk about that.
Well, the question is that I find during the course of the research any unusual aspects of the research or any rare recordings or things that would really make me stand back and say, wow, that's really amazing. I had the the opportunity, rare opportunity, in the, I guess it must have been the late 1980s. I was between books. I was living in New Jersey, and a good friend of mine, Dave Marsh, who is a Springsteen biographer, you may know him. He runs the, he does a serious radio show on Bruce Springsteen, but great, great writer from Rolling Stone and Cream, a colleague of mine, and he was going to put together a book with Woody Guthrie's manager. His name was Harold Leventhal. He's passed a couple of years ago. He was also Pete Seeger's longtime manager. And they had his, Woody Guthrie's wife, Marjorie, had stored, it was really the Guthrie collector, and stored tons and tons of things in boxes all over the place. And so it was his idea that people should know about Woody Guthrie, and they should know about these incredible writings. The man wrote seemingly every minute of every day. I mean, he was beyond prolific. It was incredible. Journal entries, novels, certainly songs, letters. He did illustrations. He did cartoons. He painted signs. He was just nonstop. I don't know what he could have done other than simply write. I mean, there's just so much stuff. Anyway, they wanted to pick out the best things, put out a book called Pastures of Plenty, the Writings of Woody Guthrie. So they needed someone to basically do the research. Dave Marsh knew that I was a big Woody Guthrie fan and asked if I would become the researcher. So I tell the story today, and Nora Guthrie just shivers. Like, oh, my God, I can't imagine this. But I would literally take a box, sit on a New York subway, take it home, and take it to my dining room table, and over the weekend spread it out. And I went through all of this stuff. It was, I'm like, you can imagine an archaeologist or someone going and just taking home giant pieces of the desert or something and just sifting through it. But that's what it was like. It was incredible to find all this stuff. And I'm thinking, wow, I get to see this. Many people hadn't seen it except for those who had, you know, the letters had been sent to. It hadn't been open in years. So I went through all of this stuff, and one of the great moments, I think I mentioned this in the introduction, I was a big fan of This Land Is Your Land, and we came across, and Harold Leventhal says, go ahead and go to the Xerox machine. We called it a Xerox machine back then. Go to the Xerox machine and make a copy for yourself. And I walked away with this Xerox copy of This Land Is Your Land. No one had ever even seen it there other than the family members. And I put it on my wall as my absolute inspiration until it yellowed, because back then, you know, the copies weren't like they are today. And but, you know, to read some of this stuff was amazing. So 7 years later, the Woody Guthrie archives were actually born. And when I was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, one of the first things I did was I did a program that celebrated Woody Guthrie. And I had Springsteen and Pete Seeger and Arlo Guthrie and Dave Perner, Indigo Girls, Ani DiFranco, cast of dozens come in and celebrate. And we raised a bunch of money so that I could say that not only did I find some of this stuff, I actually helped preserve it. And it, for a music historian and for someone who adores Woody like I do, you can't ask for a better gig than that. And I think finally we were able, and Andrew McKay in the background, a colleague of mine from EMP, but EMP found the very first Woody Guthrie guitar, and Paul Allen had the insight and the wallet to purchase the Woody Guthrie guitar so it didn't leave this country. It was in danger of leaving this country. And Paul and EMP saved the day and kept that guitar here. And thankfully, it's right now that guitar is in France in a Bob Dylan exhibit. I borrowed it from EMP. Thank you, EMP. But thanks seriously to Paul Allen. He saved that guitar. And so now, since then, a second guitar has been found. Woody had many, many guitars. Gave them away, lost them, broke them, never used the case. But this Martin guitar, an awesome guitar, is here for America. And so is the second one, which happened to be found in the state of Washington, in a pawn shop, actually. So so we have two that are known, and they're preserved. So having been a part of that, those that are real, I mean, I could, as far as being a curator, I can retire. I feel like I've done my part, you know, especially something as meaningful as Woody Guthrie's guitar. Yes, ma'am.
A couple things.
Yes.
You probably are aware that Arlo Guthrie and his family are going to be traveling from the East Coast to New Orleans on the train.
City of New Orleans. Okay. Yeah.
And I think that's so exciting, and I'm really looking forward to it. And the second thing is, I'm a retired high school history teacher, and I'm very proud to say that Woody Guthrie's music was the basis of my teaching of U.S. history.
Well, thank you. That's great to know. That's great to know. Well, you're absolutely right. You can teach American history through Woody Guthrie. Both sides of American history, actually, you can do that. And that's great that you do that and that you did that. As far as this is the centennial, and you should know that the Grammy Museum and the Guthrie family, we've teamed up this year to create a series of programs and an exhibit that celebrates Guthrie's legacy. Woody was born in Oklahoma, and we began the celebration in March in Tulsa, Oklahoma. University of Tulsa had a major conference on Guthrie. We did a big concert with John Mellencamp, with Old Crow Medicine Show, Del McCurry, Jackson Brown, and others in Tulsa. Guthrie then moved to Pampa, Texas, so we went to Pampa, Texas, and Arlo did a big concert in Pampa, Texas. We went down to South by Southwest, did a big program there. Springsteen did his program on Woody Guthrie as well. After that, Woody Guthrie moved to Los Angeles, and we did something at USC, a big conference at USC in April, and then a big concert right by the Grammy Museum. Now we head east, because Guthrie headed east, and we go to Brooklyn College, and we go to Penn State, actually, to discuss labor songs. So many people are out of work, miners and auto workers and steel workers in western Pennsylvania. We thought, man, this is a good place to examine Guthrie's role in unions. So we'll be doing a big conference at Penn State and concerts at Penn State in early September. And then we go to Brooklyn, because Brooklyn and Coney Island was where Woody spent the latter part of his life. And then ultimately to Washington, D.C. for the finale. So if you're interested, you can go to woodyat100.org, woodyat100.org, get a listing of everything that's going on. I just gave you a couple, and there are dozens and dozens of celebrations going on, not only in this country, in Canada, and over in Europe, and even in Asia as well. It's really fascinating to see how many people have been moved by Guthrie's music to celebrate this great American artist. I don't think any musician's centennial has drawn the attention that Guthrie's has. So, and for those of you who are interested in his music, we have a box set coming out called Woody at 100 from the Smithsonian, and it includes not only his, if you will, greatest hits and the usual suspects of songs that you would expect to find on a Woody Guthrie anthology, but we also found incredible early recordings, radio recordings, because when he went down to Los Angeles, he was on KFVD, and it was a station where it was very left of center, and he played his songs, and really that's where he gets his name. I don't think we have anything from the Northwest, but in 1941, Guthrie comes up here, and maybe for about a month or so, writes amazing stuff for Grand Coulee Dam, Roll on Columbia, Pastures of Plenty. If you know those songs, they're brilliant songs, and they come from that one period after he's in Los Angeles. He comes up here, actually he's hired by the government, makes a couple hundred bucks, and gives him incredible batches of songs, heads back to New York, and then begins zigzagging across the country like a madman in some cases, but clearly someone who, wherever he went, he felt he had to write a song about it. So there's lots of songs about lots of places.
I think it's amazing that his family continues on and has their own groups and sing.
Yeah, you know, the comment is that it's amazing that his family carries on, the Guthrie family carries on. It does. And I got to give a lot of credit to Arlo, because when you're the son of a very famous musician, it's very difficult to get out of your father or mother's, as the case may be, their shadow. And not only has Arlo done that, but Arlo's done that in style. So he still has his own career, and yet he certainly pays homage to his father as well. If you hear him sing some of Woody's songs, they'll bring you to tears. And on the other hand, you know, is there a better song than Alice's Restaurant, right?
No. I mean,
and the best thing about it was, just before the record comes out, in November of 1967, right around Thanksgiving, Woody Guthrie dies in October, so just before it comes out. But one of the last things that he heard was a test pressing of Alice's Restaurant. So Woody Guthrie heard it. When I interviewed Arlo, Guthrie says, yeah, he heard it, and it killed him. Anyway. anything else I can answer, any other comments? Comments are great. Yeah.
You were asking about Occupy Seattle. Yeah, we did have one of the sites at Seattle Central as a community college here, but I loved when there was one particular bus driver who, when he got to that stop, instead of saying Seattle Central, he said Occupy Seattle.
That's great. Yeah, that's great.
And then the other thing is, actually, I teach English as a second language, and I use this land as your land because there's imagery, there's metaphor, there's geography.
You bet.
Content. And the other thing is, there's so many audio recordings, so I can test them a lot on what they really understand by using different musicians.
Right, right.
So
right.
It turned out to be incredible songs.
That's great. That's great. Guthrie's songs are really short stories put to music. You know, there's if you teach literature, you know, there's character development, there's plot, there's setting, there's tension, there's themes. I mean, they're fantastic. Check out a song, for those of you who don't know, 1913 Massacre. If you don't know that song, whoa, bring it to tears. Powerful, powerful song. Or Plain Wreck at Los Gatos or Deportees. Then there's Pastures of Plenty, which was written up here. I think one of his second, maybe the second best song he ever wrote. If you don't know that and you like This Land Is Your Land, same kind of feel. It's about America and the poetic quality of the verses. Absolutely stunning and brilliant. Just hit you right here, you know. And there are so many more like that. And the interesting is there's so many in the archives. Nora Guthrie has done a great thing. She has begun to let these lyrics out or given them to people like Billy Bragg or the group Wilco, Jeff Tweedy, and others to put music to them. So a song like, I don't know if you may know California Stars. We know it because of California. We play it all the time in California. But it's a song that Woody wrote, no music, and I believe Jeff Tweedy put the music to that. And boy, it's a beautiful one. It's on the Mermaid Avenue album. If you don't know, it's Billy Bragg and Wilco. It's called Mermaid Avenue. It's called Mermaid Avenue because that's where Woody Guthrie lived, in Coney Island, Mermaid Avenue. Well, look, I appreciate your time and your support and letting me talk a little bit about one of my favorite, if not my favorite, topics. So thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Robert Santelli, Executive Director of the Grammy Museum and the author of This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Santelli spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on May 23, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum.
Was made for you and me.
Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Today's KUOW Day sponsors are Tom Bailey, celebrating the Lake Union Wooden Boat Festival July 4th through the 7th, and Catherine Walker, wishing both Sarah Walker and Greg Walker a very happy birthday.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.